I'm Andrew Finney, and welcome to Series 4 of the Nurse Researcher Podcast, a podcast aimed at being able to sort of dig deep into the lives of nurse researchers at all levels. This new series will be the PhD student series, and we're really looking forward to be able to hear back from and listen to people that have just completed a PhD or are currently undertaking a PhD. So listen in and enjoy. Hello and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. And we are on a new series, but not necessarily a new guest. So the new series is going to be the PhD student. This is your first episode. And my first guest is Eleanor Hovard. You'll know her as our summarizer. Today, it's all about Eleanor's story. I can't think of a better way of starting this series. So Eleanor, in a different way, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much, Andrew. It's great to be back. Delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. And thankfully, you didn't put up a fight. I thought, as long as she doesn't put up a fight now, because it seems right. I know where you are in your journey, but I'm not going to start with where you are now. I'm going to start at the beginning. I almost feel like I almost don't need to ask you the questions because you know what's coming. But you're going to have to tell us, why did you become a nurse?
Yeah. Okay. So this is quite interesting. I grew up in the States, nursing was not a career that I had in mind until I moved back to Coventry in England when I was about 19. So when I was younger, around about the age of 9, I always wanted to be a vet. I used to watch All Creatures Great and Small, the classic one, James Herriot. I loved his books. And I even had a toy microscope for Christmas one year. That's how much I loved science and creatures, insects. And I guess I was quite lucky, really, where we lived. I just felt like I was always surrounded by nature. We were going on walks at school to look for caterpillars and monarch butterflies. We went on whale watches. So I suppose I had this real desire to work with creatures. But the funny thing is, and this is a bit of a disclaimer, if you're eating your lunch now, maybe just pause the podcast and listen afterwards. We adopted a dog that was a rescue dog. It was a beautiful Irish setter. And on this one occasion, she was at the top of the stairs. And unfortunately, we discovered she had roundworm. Now, if you've ever had a dog and they've had roundworm, it's really not a pretty sight. And it was at that moment I was like, oh, no, I definitely cannot be a vet. So that put me off being a vet for the rest of my life. But I definitely loved science throughout my whole school years, which was all in the States. And I think because they did have a strong science curriculum over there, I really benefited from that. And it's funny, I remember my mum's medical book. I don't know if your parents had medical books. My mum had this medical book, she'd always look things up. And I found that really fascinating. So I'd always go through this medical book and just kind of enjoy reading about different kinds of illnesses and things. So I guess I always had an interest in health as well. And then I did a year at university in the States in New Hampshire. I went to college for a year and studied biology. But it's still at that point, I don't think I really knew exactly what I wanted to do. And then we moved back to England when I was 19. So that was quite a critical point for me, I think. But looking at it positively, it was good because it also helped me to reflect on what I was studying, where I wanted to go. And I essentially took a gap year when I moved back to England just to get a job, meet people. And actually, funny enough, I worked at Tesco's for a year. I worked on the fish counter so I can gut a fish if ever you need somebody to gut a fish. And then I guess I probably had enough of that, really. And actually, at the time, this was coming up to the new Project 2000 course. So there was an opportunity, to apply for a nursing course, the Project 2000 one. And at the time, we also had a bursary. So it was very inviting. And I applied. And that's how I sort of started my nursing journey, I guess. And both you and I think were part. Were you on the Project 2000 as
yes.
well?
Yes, yeah, 97 yeah. to 2000 I was.
Yeah, exactly the same time then when we did our nurse training. And it's a funny thing, really, because it was heavily theoretical, wasn't it? And quite academic. And I was always quite academic at school, so maybe that suited me. And some of my first placements as a student nurse, I look back and I think, wow, how did I ever stick through this? Because, they could be quite difficult, can't they, at times. I loved my community nursing placement. That was probably one of my most favorite ones. That was in Bidford upon Avon near Stratford. So I guess that's how I got into nursing. I was always fascinated by research.
You're jumping too far ahead. This is what I'm saying. You know the questions. I'm going to slow you down. You're going to go too far. What I'm going to point out first of all, if anybody joins this episode maybe 2 minutes in, they're going to hear you say you always wanted to work with creatures and you got a fish. And I hope they don't think that's applicable to your nursing career and that you're. So she wasn't calling her patients creatures. She was talking about animals.
Gone from wanting
But
to
you. So you're. I mean. You do have to sort of pause that a little bit because there's a lot there, isn't there, with the education in the United States, and we have to be careful. Well, we don't have to be careful what we say as such, but there is a sense that most people would agree who did the training that we did that actually that bursary was a huge part of being able to be a nurse. It gives you the little platform that you need. I think my bursary was about
Absolutely.
£250 a month. It wasn't a great deal, but it's a hell of a lot more than having to pay for your own tuition. But you will have done a diploma then, not a degree.
No, I did do a degree. It was an
Oh, you, oh,
ordinary
Project
degree.
2000 degree. Okay.
It was an ordinary degree that I graduated with. And that was at Coventry University. So maybe that was just something that they offered there, perhaps. I can't actually remember because it was that long ago. It was 24, 25 years ago now. It's amazing, isn't it, how it all becomes a bit of a blur. But yeah, the bursary was definitely good incentive, I think, when you're young and you're wanting to become independent. I bought my first car, all those things that you can do. And obviously that was very helpful if you're going on community nursing placements as well. So there is a lot of incentive, I think, from the
I mean,
bursary.
we can't turn the clock back. We can't change the way that things are now.
No.
But I think that what we shouldn't do is hide the value of what the bursary did bring. If you did a degree, then I suppose you, when you do a diploma like I did, you don't really, you consider it almost a training alongside the what is feels like quite a vocational course at the time. It was very theoretical, but it was like the theory that went with your vocational occupation. I didn't get the sense of the true profession, the academic requirements, and the academic opportunities whilst I was doing my diploma. But you were going for that bachelor award. Did you do well? What did you get? Dare I ask? Is it okay to ask?
Well, yeah, you can, but it's actually I think ordinary degree, there was no sort of it was just called an ordinary degree. So either this is my ignorance or it's just pass or fail. So I think at the time there wasn't any sort of merit distinction for the
No, so no
degree.
classification with it either.
No,
No.
because I have looked back on my records and that wasn't there. I don't know if that's the same for other people, but that's how my record appears. So I
Any
think it was
research in
probably
that training though? Any research module? Any sense of research aligned to the role of nursing?
the smallest amount. I can remember a lecture. Unfortunately, I can't remember the lecturer's name, but I can remember her talking to us about qualitative and quantitative research. It probably spans less than a week, I think, maybe even a couple of lectures on research, and that was it. And actually, I mean, I'm probably going to skip ahead again now, but I mean, even as a student nurse, and into my qualified years as a nurse, we weren't really exposed to research. It was really a medical thing. I remember seeing posters up behind the nursing station, but they were all with the doctors' names on. I remember one research nurse, probably I must have been qualified, perhaps was I just qualified maybe? I remember she used to come onto the ward. But there was no integration. There was no integration at all. It didn't feel like into the nursing team. Nobody, I don't recall anybody speaking about research really as a nurse. This is 24, 25 years ago. So we have
So
come a long, long way, really.
usually, and I'll say it because it even though it would sound rude at the time, but 20, 25 years ago when I was in that position with you and there was a few research nurses where I worked, I thought pen pushing, it's just a pen pushing job. I just sort of filling in forms, consenting people and thinking, oh, it's almost like an administrative job, which I know now would be so far from the truth. So I'm not, that's not me playing down the role of, research delivery. But at the time, that was my view because I didn't know enough. So it was them and us a little bit, really. They were downstairs in offices and we were sort of changing beds, cleaning
Very
patients,
much
caring for
so.
patients. And it was us and them. So I suppose a barrier went up for me as a sense of, well, I'm not a practical or a proper nurse if I go and do one of their roles. A few years later, I was doing some of the research nurse role. So what gave you that little bit of the bug of research then you were about to tell us?
Well, it really, I mean, I worked on coronary care units and I worked in cardiology on call and cath lab suite for probably almost a decade. And it was after I had my son, so I have two children. I took a role as a cardiac rehabilitation nurse, which just fit in with family life for me better. And it was then actually that I was exposed more to research. But interestingly, it was because one of the exercise physiologists, who's now a professor, he was an NIHR doctoral fellow at the time. And it was him, I think, that spoke more about research. And I remember one of the professors he was working with, he brought to one of the cardiac rehab sessions. I was talking to him, showing him around, that sort of thing. So it really gave me some interest. And I guess we spent maybe a couple of days with him. And I guess we were also helping him to recruit patients that had heart attacks to his own study as well. So what it made it become is something that was attainable and an option, an opportunity for nurses as well. But actually, I didn't at the time, I didn't even know what an NIHR fellowship was. I mean, they must have been pretty new at that time, I think. He must have been one of the first ones to get one. So I was looking, so that did inspire me. I looked for research posts as a nurse. And at that time was when the clinical research networks, what were the clinical research networks? There was the Primary Care Clinical Research Network. And there's a job that came up that I applied for, and I was fortunate to get that job. And the rest is history, really. I mean, it was a job that I think I realized I'd wished I had the opportunity to have done much sooner, because it really kind of fit with my interests and found it really fascinating and intellectually stimulating, because I was working in an environment where there was clinical trials, but working in a multidisciplinary team with GPs, professors, you kind of had it. For me, it was like you got the whole mix, the academic and the whole clinical side as well.
Your title in that job, what was the so what was the
So I
sort
was
of
a
JD of that?
clinical research nurse. So my role was to support GP practices in setting up and delivering clinical trials. That was in Coventry. So I was based mostly at one practice to begin with, and then started helping other practices, and then supporting my colleagues around the West Midlands. And obviously now we have the regional research delivery network. So I was one of those delivery nurses, but I really enjoyed the role very much so.
And you get with the research delivery role, whether you want to or not, you get a practical research training. You're not doing a PhD, so you're not doing a research training in the academic sense, but you get so much knowledge in research delivery that you're almost on the front foot when it comes to wanting to be independent in research,
Absolutely.
aren't you?
Yeah. I think for me, it was highly valuable. I think research nurses in those roles, you are gaining such valuable skills, like you say, around informed consent, site files, understanding the whole governance and the delivery of clinical trials that many PhD students that are working in health and care research probably wouldn't have. And so that insight, I think, is incredibly valuable. It does kind of get you on the right footing. And of course, you're also learning about new studies that are developing, how those ideas come about. So, and understanding, study support services, all those things that you have to learn as a researcher, a part of your job. And also the challenges. And that's where my research came from, and that's really what ignited my
So
desire to do my PhD.
I think if we've got people in research delivery positions listening to this podcast, and I hope we have, because certainly we really credit it and understand it. And I think you and I will probably do a future series about the research delivery nurse role. Perhaps I haven't told you that yet, but I hope we do. But I think for me, my thoughts is always, but then you're a little bit trapped because you get that good at it, you're that good at supporting other people's studies, whether you're a co-applicant or, and there's real values to that. So who gave you that opportunity to sort of move out of it to be able to develop yourself rather than developing other people's studies?
So, I mean, I probably should credit a few people, really, but there was one individual. So, a GP that we worked very closely with that was the clinical director, Professor Jeremy Dale. I spoke to him when I first sort of had an interest of developing my clinical academic career. And he was wholeheartedly fully supportive of helping me to work up applications and ideas. But also, I have to credit our research delivery manager and my line manager as well, because I think you need those individuals as well to be able to support you, because it does take you out of your role a bit if you apply and you're successful. So you need a number of people. But Jeremy was he kind of took me under his wing, and I think he could see that I was really determined and really wanted to develop a clinical academic career, or academic as it's turned out.
And thank you for
I
being
was really grateful for his
probably the
support.
first guest not to sort of align it to serendipity, luck, or being in the right place at the right time. He's
True.
spotted you, hasn't he, and thought, I can develop you and you'll do really well. So you have to get yourself into these positions. It's hard to, if you're doing well as a research delivery nurse, why would people want you to go? Because you're a real credit to the service. And that's often the case in all roles within nursing. If you do well, why would people want to release you and even have your backfill money? Because that backfill money doesn't replace you, it just replaces a body, doesn't it? So to give you that little bit of a launch pad, was it to go for a pre-doctorate, a master's? What was the plan?
Yeah, so I kind of went through the whole kit and caboodle. So at the time when I took an interest, I mean, there's plenty of failure before this as well. I was looking for opportunities to work with other professors. I applied for a PhD studentship at one point and failed miserably with that. But actually, the better, as it turns out, the better route for me was to, at the time, apply for a clinical academic internship program. So that was offered at the time by University Hospitals Birmingham. So it was like a 6 month course. That was a good sort of footing, I think, to understand if it's going to be for you, the clinical academic route. You learn the basics, kind of how to search for literature. You get exposure to other individuals that are in the same situation as you, thinking about the clinical academic route. And then I knew it was for me, so applied for an NIHR pre-doctoral clinical fellowship not long after that. First time I didn't get it. I was and I didn't I think for any listeners out there, what I didn't appreciate was the time it takes to develop a really good application for the NIHR fellowships. So I think my application was fundable, I was told, but of course that's the other thing I wasn't aware of, was that it kind of ranked, basically. So if you don't make the cutoff, then even if your research is fundable, you don't make the cut, basically. It's one of the brutal sort of parts of academia. And that is where I think you have to decide, right, are you willing to persevere and go through this application process all over again? Because it takes a long time. And I did. I thought, no, I'm up for this challenge. I definitely want to do this. So applied again, and the application was much, much better. Took much more time, and obviously the patient public involvement aspect was really important as well to work into that. And obviously was successful with that, and that was a real springboard. Then 2 years, I was able to do my master's in health research at Warwick Medical School. And I guess one other thing that's worth mentioning for any listeners out there as well, because I didn't have a master's in health research. And to do that in a whole pre-doctoral clinical academic fellowship would have been a challenge. So I applied for some funding again from, I think it was the West Midlands Academic Partnership in Birmingham. So they were able to fund me for a couple of modules just to sort of give me a bit of a running start, really. And I think that helps as well. So I think look for other opportunities if you don't have what you need to almost fulfill the basics of applying for a fellowship. Look for the right people to support you. And Hannah Ray, who was the head of workforce development in the CRN, she helped me with that. So it's finding the people that can support you as well. So as I say, it's not just one person. It's usually a village that helps you, to get so far.
But what you've got almost a perfect pathway there. So the ICA would have been your first internship, is that what they were called at the time? You did the ICA, then the pre-doc. But it's important for people to hear that you didn't get it the first time, but then you keep going, you build on your feedback and you keep going. Your feedback was good, so you just knew that actually there isn't infinite money.
And
You
I
were
think that's
fundable, but there wasn't enough money.
And I think that's the thing. I remember reading the email. We were on holiday in France at the time, and I was gutted. I was really disappointed because I thought, oh no, and of course I had that support though as well from Professor Jeremy Dale and also Sophie Stanisewska, who's now my primary supervisor. And they were really encouraging. So I think, you need that support as well. But it is disheartening. But I do think you probably get used to that a bit as you go along in academia. You develop a resilience.
It always stings, and you've got this to come yet, because it stings far more often postdoctoral, because you're constantly applying for funding. But we jump ahead. This is about you. So all the steps of the ladder are there at the minute. The ICA, so the internship, the Masters in Health Research, the pre-doc. What brought the doctorate forward? You're obviously preparing for that, but tell us a little bit about your PhD. So what you were pitching to the NIHR and what fellowship you got.
So my motivation to do my PhD and to develop an NIHR clinical doctoral research fellowship came very much from my job as a clinical research nurse. So I was based in a practice in Coventry, in a very deprived area, where we had low recruitment to studies. And I knew from when I first started my post, I could see who was taking part in health and care research. We're much more aware of this now. It's high on the agenda for the NIHR inclusion, but I could see that my colleagues that were working in Stratford and other areas of the West Midlands were recruiting huge amount of patients, and they were generally white British male. But I guess, I felt quite frustrated because I could see that actually the people that probably needed the benefits from health and care research weren't, either getting access or weren't taking part. And I could see that the difficulties as to why that was. But at the time, there was less understanding, I think, that actually it's the way we were delivering health and care research that was the problem. So by doing my own research, that was a way to address the issue through, scientific discovery. So it kind of fulfilled my desire not only to do research, but also to do something that I thought I could actually help to address a serious challenge that was applicable in so many different ways. It was important, it also benefited, lots of benefits, benefit the research network, patients in the public practices, etc. So my motivation came from that experience of observing those inequities in research.
And that's gender, culture, all sorts of diverse issues where we weren't really getting the diverse samples, and you weren't really recruiting people representative of the population that you were trying to serve.
Absolutely not. Yeah, that's right. And these are the patients and members of the population that have much poorer health conditions than other people. So, the implications for that are massive, really, in that they're not getting the benefits of the treatments that other individuals are. And of course, we don't know how to tailor treatments and care to different individuals if we're working with just essentially one population. So really, really important.
Okay, so PhD title.
Yep, so my PhD is called Developing an Inclusive Health and Care Research System, but specifically with people from Black African diaspora communities. So I've undertaken a realist evaluation to do that. So a realist approach is about understanding what works for whom, how, why, and under what circumstances. So it allows you to consider lots of contextual factors, the messiness of these really wicked problems. So I have to say, I did a realist review for my master's dissertation, and I vowed never to do another realist review because it's quite complex to understand without any training, and I did that without any training. Fortunately, when I had my fellowship, I could take some training, so I did the realist methodology course at Oxford. I did other workshops, and now, I actually love taking a realist approach because I really understand it, and that's part of the pain of doing a PhD. You've got to learn, and a lot of it's self-directed.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lucrative PhD, an NIHR doctoral fellowship. You're in a strong position there. So you've got the badge. You've got all the badges from the NIHR. You're building up this really strong career. It all seems perfect, but then you're trying to do a PhD with a family and a job and other things to do. How has it been?
It was tough. I'm not going to lie. There's no point in putting rose-tinted glasses on things. It's not easy. Again, I was fortunate because my clinical workload was 20% of my working week. The rest was academic. As I say, I've got two children. They were older. I don't know if it's any ideal time to ever do to do a PhD. But there were challenges along the way. There was things like jury duty came up. I was lucky though, that didn't last too long. Then my son needed major surgery. All these things. I broke my foot, fell down a manhole. All
I
these
know these stories, so I'm not going to open them up.
life happens, doesn't it? And so it always creates extra challenges. But that, I think, you have to really want to do a PhD because you need that desire at those times when things get really tough. I've got to do this. I really want to do this. And I will do this. You've got to kind of have that mindset, I think, to be able to get through it. But there are times on the journey, I think, when you get your first publication or you publish your protocol that you've been working on for what seems like months, and actually you know that it probably shouldn't take that long when as you develop on your academic journey. So those things are, I think, the rewarding aspects as well. But also I worked with a co-production group with individuals from Black African diaspora communities throughout my PhD. And that for me was extremely rewarding. And I loved patient public involvement as well before I started my fellowship. So for me, it was like this joy of combining everything that I really liked in my career together.
I'm going to ask you probably not a difficult question, but I think a question that probably the listener will be thinking. The population and the sample that you're representing, you don't represent, so there's a sense that you're a white middle class woman and you're representing what you're talking about is probably black people from deprived areas not getting heavily involved in research that can help them. This is a black African population that you're talking about. I can see the values in having, if you like, a white woman being able to also support the cause, but there would be people that turn around to say, well, how can you be representative of this population? Have you had that?
Yeah, it is interesting. It's something that I've reflected on in my PhD, and I'm sure it'll probably come up in my Viva as well at the end of in a couple of months. But I was asked by some interview participants, why did you want to do this research? Why are you doing this research? By I'd say at least 50%. But once people realize that you're not just doing this for the accolades, you're doing this because it's come from a role where you've observed working with patients and members of the public, and you have the skills to be able to do something about it and work in solidarity with individuals from that community, people then understand, okay, actually she's genuine. But also, I work very closely with a patient public mentor from the Black Caribbean community, and trust, is really important that trust isn't broken. And so at times he was also able to give me testimonials to the Black community as well. And I think that is important because of the lack of trust from historical injustices and the legacy of slavery,
And of course,
that
you can be a voice for people without having to be a voice of people. And that's in any walk of life.
Yeah, you can. I think what I tried to do through my PhD was because I co-produced it, I wanted the voices of Black people to be central, really. So through working with them, it was their voices, really. I suppose I was kind of leveraging that in a way. And together, you know, we I worked with a member of the group who's a poet, Roy McFarlane. He wrote some of the findings through his lens as a black man. And that poem has been produced as a video. We produced a vision, values, guiding principles together. So their voice is very much at the forefront of this research and continues to be that way. We are still meeting together to create impact. So I for me, it's always been about solidarity and doing this together.
But a real, fabulous cause, and one that we hear about a lot of people from different minority backgrounds really trying to push this message about inclusiveness in research. So I think it shouldn't be pushed by a culture. It should be pushed by everybody, shouldn't it? So I think it's wonderful, the PhD that you're doing, and I know people I've spoken to are very, they sing the praises of what you've been trying to do and what your PhD is offering. So credit to you for that. The PhD, we've talked about your family. We've talked about really the life sometimes gets in the way of the PhD, but it has to, and it has to take precedent. What tips would you give to people that, because not everybody's going to be able to be as successful as you, and I know it's not been easy, but you've still been successful on these awards. So people will be battling to get onto a pre-doctoral award, or to get onto a doctoral award, or to have to perhaps do a lesser one, or a studentship, or a PhD in their own time, which is not funded in the same way. What sort of what lessons have you learned? What tips would you give to people that are having to do this and with that work-life balance?
I mean, it is challenging. I think you do have to make such a personal sacrifice. I think when you do your PhD and you'll speak to different people, and some people will say, I mean, a few people said to me, oh, I managed mine at 9 to 5 and didn't work the weekends. I couldn't do that. It just didn't work. But I think what I knew that I learned was that I was at my most productive when I did make sure that I didn't completely pummel it and wear myself out and burn out. So I think as much you put a lot of pressure on yourself when you're doing a PhD as well. But I think it's really important that you do give yourself a break. And my supervisors were absolutely incredible at just giving me the permission to say, right, you really need to take a break. Make sure you take a week off. And just hearing somebody say that to you is really helpful because it's always there on your shoulder, this PhD. But you will work much better if you do give yourself a bit of a breather. I think as well, network as much as you can, because it's those connections that will stimulate your ideas, your thinking. Don't be afraid to reach out to people, other academics, experts, healthcare professionals. Don't be afraid. I think sometimes people are a bit fearful of emailing a professor or somebody in their field. But if they ignore your email, then they ignore your email. Don't let it put you off. Somebody will pick up your email at some point. Perseverance is really important, isn't it? With everything. And I guess just try not to let it take over your whole life. I think once you get towards the end of your PhD, especially once you submit, it's like, you know, it's just such a great feeling. And you do feel like I've got a little bit of my life back because there is, you know, it does consume so much of it. But your support networks are important as well. Friends, family,
And the
you've
Viva
got to make
experience.
sure. Haven't got there yet. I'm waiting. Well, I've got a date. You can maybe we can do an extra bonus session. I
Well,
can
I think
explain how that
we
goes,
can
but
tag it onto one of the summaries, can't we? So how long have you got left to wait?
it's 28th of November, so what have I got? 6 weeks or so.
Okay, because I tended to I found that a very difficult time. So the time that you're in now, I was like, I would prefer to do it tomorrow. That's what I know what I know now. I can't keep reading it, and I'm not reading it now. I'm looking at it. I'm looking at words. I'm not taking them in now because I wrote them. So are you feeling that? And this is good for people to know because all of these episodes of people are going to be at different stages. So if you could have your Viva tomorrow, would you?
No, not yet. It's been a very busy month and I've got quite a lot coming up. So I'm actually really glad the way it's worked out. What I have done, however, is I've created a bit of a crib sheet for myself, a spreadsheet. Lots of questions on there that I try and just add my own answers to every now and again. One of the other things, I don't know how other people have found this. I had my thesis printed, even though I know it's going to need corrections. But for me, just being able to flip through it, A, you think I've done this, so that's a real uplifting thing. But you can, you know, you're just trying to absorb it as much as you can over and over. I am fortunate because I'm still I'm working as a researcher on a realist reviews, so the methodology for me is always there. So I'm probably learning more all the time as I go with that. So yeah, it's just a time thing with me. I just need a bit. That's always the case, isn't it? You always need a bit longer. But I'm actually, yeah, half looking forward to it and half terrified. But I'll let you know how it goes afterwards.
So you've almost got the postdoc job whilst you're waiting to just
Yeah,
get finalize the
bit back to
doctorate.
front. Yeah, a bit back to front. But in some ways, it's been beneficial, I think.
So my last question for you would be, we sort of know what's next because you've got this job, you're doing realist evaluation, you're almost working in a postdoctoral job now, so you've got that platform. What's the next ambition for you? You can
Yeah.
say a holiday if that's what it is.
Yeah, well, I definitely, yeah, I had a holiday. I'm definitely gonna need some more rest. To continue developing as an academic. I mean, I think the thing is, I feel like because of my nursing career and because of my academic experience, it's actually, I feel like I've got opportunities there if I need them. But I'm just settling into becoming just a pure academic now. I think it takes a little bit of time to get used to the pace. The pace is much faster. I'd like to become less of a perfectionist. There are probably more personal goals at the minute because I feel like I've achieved a lot, in the last 3 years. So they're more sort of working on personal goals, giving myself a little bit more time when I need it. Always developing my writing.
And the postdoc grant, it's in the distance, no doubt.
Yeah, I'd love to, and definitely will be working on developing an application to build upon my PhD research findings. We're working on some patient public involvement recommendations. I still need to get the publication out from that. So there's loads going on there. But yeah, definitely, I've got lots of ideas. So just kind of finding my feet really in academia and working towards that. I will be working towards that next goal.
Well, we'll have a lovely order to these episodes as they go out. So this will be the first episode that people hear, and then we'll follow up your success, I'm going to say, in a later episode. So Eleanor, rather than saying thank you for your summary, thank you for your episode. I've learned new things about you. There's things I didn't know there. I knew about you falling down a manhole, but there's things that I didn't know. So thank you for your time. Much
Oh,
appreciated.
thank you so much. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for
See you.
having me.
Thanks, Eleanor. Bye.
Bye bye.
Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. And if this was a surprise episode, then this is a surprise summary. I am delighted to say the summarizer for this episode is no other than Dr. Joanne Cooper. So, Joe, I'm
Thank
going to
you.
let you introduce yourself.
Hi, yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for the invitation. So, yeah, my name's Jo Cooper. I'm Deputy Director of Nursing Research for System Transformation at NHS England. I'm also an Honorary Professor at the University of Nottingham.
Fabulous. And I'm delighted to have you. You've been a huge advocate for certainly for research and nursing as part of your role, and a real person that's been so engaging with us as the workforce. And I think the first person to sing your praises would be Eleanor Hoverd. So it's probably worth asking you how you know Eleanor before I ask you to do the summary with me.
Thank you. Thanks for those kind words. An absolute privilege for me too to be part of this summary for Eleanor. So I first met Eleanor, I think pretty much early into my role at NHS England, what's probably NHS England an improvement then. And already showing her passion and curiosity, she was developing a community practice around primary care, community care nursing, but particularly the primary care space, which was and still is an area of real growth. So I met Eleanor then. And then through further opportunities, Eleanor came to work with me as part of our team. And, as I was listening to her, she just exuded all of what you've heard in that podcast as part of her role with us, myself and Professor Alison Richardson. So absolutely privileged to be here today to share my thoughts and views on it, but to have worked with her. And what you hear is exactly what you experience when you're working alongside her. So good to those that are now securing her employment is all I can say. They've got a great gem there.
And I've got a little story to tell, really, that I think this podcast is very much down to the likes of you and Eleanor, because I think I met you through a community of practice that Eleanor had put
That's right.
together. And we started to talk a little bit about, I think you suggested that I might want to interview people to ask about research careers, possibly for a little video for a landing page.
Yeah.
And I'll take that as a positive, that because even my grandma used to say I had the gift of the gab. But I think then we spun it a little bit and said we could make this a podcast. And
Yes,
you're both very supportive of that.
well, no, and thank you to you. I mean, clearly I was delegating work, wasn't I, already at that point? And podcasts were, would you believe, quite relatively new, weren't they? And certainly a gap in this space. So, absolutely brilliant to be able to do this and to hear, I think, the personal journey of the individual outside that space of the academic endeavor or, those normal presentations. I think it's just what we need to hear to bring it alive and make it possible for us to see that in real life. So,
Yeah.
yes, thank you.
It's lovely, and I think that was always the motivation. We were saying to one another, you can never go up to somebody's conference and ask them the things that this podcast can
Yes.
ask them, and you can never get that sort of rich data, really, which is what it is. But I think the stories that we've had over the previous three series have really inspired people, and I think these PhD journeys are going to do the same for people to hear. It isn't necessarily always straightforward. It isn't nicely aligned. The research journey is one of peaks and troughs, and there's always, life often gets in the way, as we said to Eleanor. And I think, listening to her, knowing her for a number of years now, through you particularly, I learned a lot about her. But I'm probably going to put this to you. I always say to Eleanor, right, what's your take on the interview? What's your take on the interviewee? So what's your take on that, Joe? What's your take on this interview, on this podcast?
Yeah, so thank you. I mean, really got an insight into the Eleanor that I possibly thought was there, but a lot that I didn't know. So I was aware that Eleanor had spent some time in the US, but not that she'd really been educated there, and certainly not that she'd be considered being a veterinary surgeon or in that field of practice. So what I would say is, what's veterinary services loss is our gain. But I know that she helped and really drew on that as part of her PhD ideas and the connections that she had, particularly around dissemination and looking for underrepresented groups. So that was a real thing. Certainly didn't realize she got fishmongering experience. So
No, no.
What you see in terms of a PhD student, we always have a lot more. But I think it was really around understanding her driving factor, the curiosity that was clearly there at the outset, the passion for science and art, and the passion for evidence that wherever she'd have ended up, and we are so glad that she's Nurses Gain, that has driven her through, whether that's through clinical practice. The importance, I think, of the funding opportunities that we have of being a Project 2000 or diploma nurse, all of those things that, that ordinary degree even that can give you. It doesn't matter where you start, it's about where you finish. And that understanding that the specialist knowledge you gain as a researcher, wherever that might be, can have real impact both on you as an individual, but particularly on the patients, the population that we're trying to improve outcomes for and with through the research that we conduct. And then I suppose also the human part of being a woman in a PhD, that life happens, that we have family, that, as a parent, the responsibilities that we have, but a PhD is possible with the people around us. And I think finally for me, what I saw, possibly reflecting as well some of my experience, is the real support that you get from your profession, but also those around you, those champions. Who does she say? GP Professor Jeremy Dale and the research managing team, the whole team, the village she describes. You're not on your own, and neither was Eleanor, and is always willing to give credit right up until the point with the importance of the team around her, of patients and public, involved in disseminating her research through poetry. So really inspiring. Yeah,
And
really
I think
great.
what I was pleased with, and I didn't warn her of this, but she's heard me say it enough, that I'm happy for people to praise other people for what you've been able to achieve, but what I don't want people praising is good luck, good fortune,
Yeah.
serendipity, because you can't be there without some skill set, and some decent characteristics of your own. So yes, we should thank those that have supported us in research, because nobody's ever done anything in research of value alone. But I think what we have to do as nurses is stop sort of digging out ourselves as being lucky and fortunate to be doing these sorts of things. And finally, she's somebody that didn't say that.
No, exactly. I think sometimes perhaps when we say that, it's about the fact we weren't able to have that roadmap. It almost feels like it's to chance, but actually, the old adage, the harder you work, the luckier you get. It's almost you do have to take the opportunities, but if you don't also have a clear trajectory, clearly that was evident in Eleanor's story. So it whilst it might not be luck and chance, it doesn't have to be totally clear either, and you can achieve it as she has.
She's a real advocate, and the greatest praise I could put on her is I viewed her as postdoctorally before she'd even really started the doctorate. She's had that ability to really, carry herself in a room, conduct herself very professionally, very skillfully, and has had the knowledge all along. Really, the PhD is just putting the cherry on the cake. She
Yeah.
comes across as somebody far more advanced in research than she is, and that's because she's taken every step on the ladder. She's worked pre-doctorally. I think the research delivery role was absolutely crucial for her undertaking and for her success. And I think over the years we've probably not looked on that with the skill set that he has. And you said something to me when we chatted just before this recording of saying, "Well, you're a research specialist nurse." I'm going to use that now, Joe. I think that's a
Oh, yeah.
fabulous thing to say. But you're right, and I think that planted the seed. That was really the platform for what she's gone on to do, the research delivery role.
Yeah. Yes. And I mean, if you think about the multi-professional research capabilities framework that we now have, if we'd have had that looking at Eleanor then, the ability to be able to conduct clinical practice within a really complex trial, real challenges around consent, people that perhaps aren't able to give consent. There's some real specialist knowledge, project management, developing studies, being involved right at the outset. Disseminating, it is a really rich role with a direct impact on practice. And you said something in it, which was, seen as pen pushers. And I think that is a real myth that they're not sitting in the office with their feet up on the table. It's really around transforming care through a specialist research lens, which still needs to develop, as all roles do. So, yes, to be absolutely celebrated. In fact, Eleanor said there's something about the joy of combining everything that we really like. And I think she's a real example of that, isn't she? Right from the passion around the topic of her PhD. But what listeners might not be aware is, and I was, that when she was with us in NHS England, you're right, you almost forget that she's not already completed a PhD. She co-developed with us a framework that we now apply to our work that really thinks around race and health and the impact of that. So that kind of invisible impact so far will have a real legacy beyond her PhD too.
Yeah, I think I mean, some people in other walks of life, you say you've got everything but the badge, and I think that's what the PhD is to her. But we don't forget equally that she's now done a strong research training through that PhD, and she's going to be a real advocate for what I think is the future of a lot of research questions, that realist methodology. Now,
Definitely.
I've already been able to go to her and say, just what were your seminal papers for Lucat? I want to read about realist evaluation, realist methodology. And she's been able to say to this person and that person and have a look at this, because she's championing that now. And I think we can't overlook the bravery of the PhD topic either.
Yes, exactly. And utilizing methods and methodologies that are really important to understand the realities of research in practice, isn't it? Really,
Yeah.
all of it is important, and it's the question that
Yeah.
drives, in my
Yeah.
opinion, that drives the method or methods that we use. But it is an area that I think, as a profession, we could really embrace. So someone like Eleanor, with that expertise, could really help us understand what context, mechanisms, and outcomes, and
Yeah.
all of that. Certainly not my area of expertise, so I might need to ask you for those papers too, Andrew. Really, really important that we understand that to give research credibility and
Yeah.
nurses credibility in that space
Yeah.
too, definitely.
But I think, Joe, I think what I was alluding to as well is that this sense of a white woman choosing to represent, a black population through their inequity and inequalities of research. People would have every right from that community to say, well, who are you to represent us? But actually, you need rep to fight a fight in anything in life. You need full representation of everybody. So, and I see lots of people through my NHR role, who might be an Asian background or Black African background, saying I'm looking at inequalities in the workforce or inequalities in research engagement or representation. To have a white middle class woman doing that is good. It's a really good thing, and I love the fact that people now see that she's doing this for the right reasons, and she what she is another voice to make sure that we're
Absolutely.
doing these things right.
Yes, and she described that as solidarity, didn't she? That was the word that she used, which really stuck out to me. I was interested when you asked that question, Andrew, because I think, there is real value in understanding our place in all of this, in terms of what we bring, in terms of race, ethnicity, our backgrounds, our views, any protected characteristics. And we all have a part to play, and it doesn't rely on one particular person, group, majority, minority to solve the issues. We have to be in this together. But I was assured, really, that how she talked about making the voices of Black people central. For example, use of video and the principles that are guiding this, because I think it is something that we need to acknowledge, and but it ought to be a part of that endeavour. So yes, I thought that was a really, really interesting part, and using the testimonials, really driving it authentically through her PhD, rather than something that might have been a tick box exercise or something being done to, rather than being done with and on part of. Yes.
And we've had on this podcast, I've had Professor Gina Higginbottom.
Yes.
I've had Professor Calvin Morley. We've had Professor Roxanne Nwabi, and each of them and all of them are delighted with what Eleanor is doing,
Yes.
for a
Yes.
culture, and for the really sort of the black minority that haven't got a voice in research,
Absolutely.
and I, this is what we're now describing as the global majority of people,
Yes.
and rightly so. And I think for Eleanor to be able to go in there and to truly represent is I just think it's brave, and I think it's going to be wonderful to see the work that she's done, and I think she can take that advocacy into the rest of her research career.
Absolutely. And it's part of what we should be doing normal, isn't it? And absolutely rightly so. Hasn't always been the case, though. So I think it's important we acknowledge the historical challenges, the racism, discrimination, and that no doubt will be front and center in terms of what Eleanor has learnt and will recommend, and her co-producers with it. And that should be front and center of all research. So definitely, interested to see what implications, what further learning we can have.
And I will touch on her viva. I said when I said to her, on your viva journey, and she said, well, it hasn't happened yet, but to me your viva journey is from the minute you submit,
Yes.
because I always think you have a mock viva, you do your prep, and what I didn't want to do is sort of explain that live as we were talking what I thought. But my viva journey started the minute I submitted, because then the panic started. I can't get it back, I've submitted it, and you see typos that you didn't see because you've been constantly reading it. You have a break and you see typos, and then you think, how do I revise and how do I prep for this? And I felt like I once I'd submitted mine, I felt like if you could say I can have my viva tomorrow, I'll do it because I'm ready. And I was surprised when she said, no, I'm not ready. I've had a busy month, and off recording, we had a chat about how she might prep and how I prepped and how she's prepping. But it would be great to speak to her on a future summary and say, how did it go?
Yes,
And I have
yes.
no doubt she'll do well.
Oh, absolutely. You perhaps it's because like she knows it so well now. Almost revisiting it wouldn't help. You know, I think we all have our own way of doing that. I had one, it's like your midviver, or what you call it, whether it's different things in different universities, but it was when you kind of
The
move on.
progression.
The progression, although mine was funded by the ESRC, so it was a kind of like a nominal one. Had an awful time, but at least that prepared me. My viva actually was really, it was thorough, and I knew my stuff, but, and there was things to change, but it was nowhere near like that. So I think, you know, we have to do what we feel is right. I'm sure she, you just know your PhD inside out, and yeah, but I do think having those mock vivas, just muscle memory of articulating your thoughts and your decisions, can be a good thing.
And
Yeah,
it's often
she'll love
harder. It's often harder to do the mock because you've possibly got peers or people that know your work a little bit.
exactly.
But I do think we'll hear a lot of that in this series of people because we'll probably get people that have just finished or people that are building up towards it. We'll get a lot of a sense of how people are prepping that. And I hope that our listeners to this podcast, certainly those aspiring to do a PhD and those doing a PhD, both benefit from this series.
Definitely. And you know, it is a something that is well and truly earned. It is something to be proud of. It is the beginning though, not the end of the journey. And if you still feel like you've got lots to learn, then so do we all. No matter how long you've been on that doctoral or postdoctoral journey, there are now, of course, through the NIHR and other routes, more opportunities for PhD and postdoctoral funding. So I'd encourage listeners to embrace that, but to do also what Eleanor's articulated and keep that team around you, grow that team. So because that'll be so important, both in terms of implementing and impactfulness of the research, but also your own journey.
It is. And there's never been a better time for nurses to want to engage in research. There's never been more input and more financial, money put behind this, despite all the financial problems we have nationally, across all work streams and across all disciplines. We're in times of austerity again. So to have that money for research and nurse-led research, I think is really important. And I'll probably be dropping in things on this podcast about, Eleanor had got all of those. I was saying you were on each rung of the ladder now, but there is the internship programs,
Yes.
and I'm really keen to support those through being a program lead for one in the West Midlands. There is the Insight programs for masters, pre-doctoral, doctoral, postdoctoral awards at lots of different levels now, and pre-application awards that really wrap around all of these. And I think if we can share some of those stories, that the funding is out there, it's just having the right network and support
It
and
is.
giving yourself the right preparation, then you'll be as successful as people like Eleanor.
Yes, and as Eleanor also, you know, there are the ups and the downs. So it isn't personal. This is just the journey of research. But leadership in any area has its ups and downs. So, you know, whilst it's a different journey, might have different jargon at times, when we're in an area we're trying to innovate and improve, there'll be some things that work so well and times when you don't necessarily progress for a little while. But you're right, getting that team around you, and embracing that. Then I think you've just got a better place to grow and to succeed and to improve things for patients and the public. And as Eleanor has really shown, if we do not consider the needs of the population that we serve, then the research that we do is not fit for purpose. So, you know, let her journey and focus be a real starting point or a continuation point for us all, really, in what high quality doctoral and postdoctoral research should be.
And I'll steal a quote from a gentleman I spoke to from Sri Lanka earlier this week. And he said, if you don't truly get representation of the population you're trying to serve in your research, it becomes evidence-based medicine and not
That's
evidence-based
interesting.
medicine. I thought that's wonderful. I'll steal
I'm
that
going
as
to pick
well.
that. Yes, me too. That
I'll be stealing
is
that
so,
one.
yeah. No, that's right. And, you know, we have a real richness of history, and needs and opportunity in our country. And for that research and public money to be used the best, then we should be doing it in the right way. And what really I would love to hear more from Eleanor when she's got through the viva is you know, the real creative ways in which she's now disseminating that and working with the group to bring it alive. Because, you know, a paper publication is one thing, but using poetry, I know there's lots of more creative art, isn't there, and different ways to share that research. So, you know, make it meaningful.
The output
Yeah.
has to fit its context, doesn't
It
it?
does,
And
absolutely.
that. But we've been very positive, so I'm going to end on not a negative, but I am going to say when I listen back to episodes so I can do the summary, my children I'll often say, Eleanor's got such a lovely voice compared to you, Dad. You know, you've got your accent and she speaks such beautiful English. And I need to ask her where she got that from, because it certainly isn't a hybrid of the US and where she then landed in Coventry. So my next
No.
question to Eleanor will be, how did you speak, where did you get this wonderful, beautiful English accent? Because my children always go, it sounds such a nice podcast when she talks, Dad.
Well, first of all, apologies in advance to your children for my Midland Nottingham accent. But yes, perhaps that could be another output of her PhD. She could create some sort of elocution
Yes,
video for us that
there you
we
go.
can, you know, speak like Eleanor series. That would be
That's
nice.
a great name for a podcast.
Yeah.
Joe, on that note, I think we've served her well, and as this one special episode with it with I'm honored to have you on to summarize, and I would always signpost people back to your live podcast if they ever want to listen to your journey. We did that live at an RCN conference, and it's a very engaging you know, and again a real open story. So I would signpost people back to your episode if they haven't heard it. And just finally, thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us and supporting the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks, Andrew. Goodbye.